I'm not sure how much optics I need to explain, so I'll just kind of wing it and look at the big issues. If the detail gets too much for you, you're welcome to ask questions or just say skip that. So the three key questions that that I would like to provide some sort of an answer are that, well, can we really say when you put one electron in a quantum semiconductor quantum dot that it really gives you a two-level system? This question turns out to be important because quantum optics people with their atoms and two-level models are very proud of that, and so they either ask questions at conferences or as referees. I got used to answering. The second one is, solid state people probably thought there's no need to make that question. The other is to actually how you want to control these spins, right, in some ways. Now, the key word is to be not just to dance, but to dance prettily. Okay? I don't want to make to teach elephants how to dance. The fact that they dance at all is that's uncharted. So that's not what we're aiming for. So the other thing is about applications. So I put it as, can you make money from it? Notice that I never say anything about earning it. So this project actually has gone on for about, unfunded, gone about 8 years, so we've been funded for about, maybe 7 or 6 or 7 years. So it has a cast of thousands, like in Hollywood production. The mainstay or the principal investigators, Dan Gunnins has a group in NIR, Duncan Steele, Michigan, and we also have some cavity work in the engineering department, optoelectronics, UCSD, and Axel Schur. I'll show you one piece of their work. And then the theory, both Duncan and I, because we're in an academic group, so you see these previous generation students and the current generation. So in 6 years, we've gone through about two generation students and two or three generations of postdocs. And it was just a delight to be working with experimentalists, and also to work with a wonderful group of students and postdocs. In this field, you can get some really good and enthusiastic students and postdocs. So there are three kinds of semiconductor quantum dots, and you probably know them, but I think it's good to remember, because of their size, that I label them increasing size, therefore their energy spacing goes down. Okay, so I would be mainly talking about these two. So they hear their problems that I don't understand. But you quite often hear about quantum dots without saying it's gated quantum dots, so that makes sense. All right. For our own collaboration, this is our first generation dots, and these are our second generation dots. And they come from Bigelow, from this niche, they're a lot smaller. The reason why we use this as first generation, because bigger dots have larger optical dipole moments, so it's easier on Duncan's group. And this is what the experimental view of the quantum dots look like. It's very neat. These blocks now are very, actually very good confinement. These are the gates that give you pools of electron gas. And this is the theory of electron. Mm-hmm. So we either put it in a box or put it in two planes and a harmonic one as well. Okay? And what we want, of course, is to isolate two spin levels energetically. The orbital level is here is anywhere from 30 electron volts to 100 electron volts. So it's well, and this is 1.5 volt, or 1 volt in the case of 1 to 1.5 volt. So they're well isolated. So the only question is, what about the Coulomb interaction or the lattice vibrations and so on? We assume that there's low enough temperature that lattice vibration, well, I say no, but lattice vibration, but actually, experimentally, we find the optical properties are not affected by photons. Part of course is the confinement. So now, the first thing about the electron-electron interaction in the periodic lattice for the semiconductor is the N plus 1 problem. Actually, Walter Kong was first, and then he worked with Luckinger, but he himself did the N plus 1 problem. That is, the N forms the semiconductor. What happens if you have the last one? Well, it's a quasar particle. I picked it up, and you can actually show quite rigorously there's a gap. This is the fundamental gap between the electron and hole. It's a spectral peak, and its width will be the phonon. Due to the phonon, if there's no phonon, it's a sharp peak, and this is a fundamental gap. This is also a gap to the continuum for both electron holes. And what Morris and I did was to take then N plus 2 problem, you can show also exciton in this ground state, except for, of course, radiative recombination. Then, once you define the quasar particle for each k value, the spatial confinement then gives you a well defined, those are well defined lines. And provided, of course, you don't have excitations so large. You know, say twice the gap, then we can have OJ effect and so on. And the other excitations you can denormalize becomes the dielectric constants and all these things. And that's what Morris and I showed quite rigorously. You don't, well, in perturbation theory to infinite order, you don't need to do Hartree-Fock theory, as even very recent papers said so. That deals with the first problem, and now I spend a whole lot of time on the. I'm watching the clock. I don't want to get my friend John mad. Then the fun part, from the physics point of view, is to look at this electron spin in the dot and its interaction with the outside world. But what we're being paid to investigate was, in fact, how to control it. And so the first thing you do is actually you have to initialize the state to get a spin, okay? The same energy can, so we work at about 4 degree K for optics, and we find that's enough. At 4 degree K, you really have to artificially cool the spin system to get the polarization. Okay, quantum, then you have to do quantum operation by optical control, and how to measure the fact that you got the spin. There's also, of course, the decoherence and the recovery. And we had a little session when I first got here already, so maybe you can see the podcast. I'd be happy to talk to you about it. I'll give you a private show. the basic fact of optical transition is that in the single particle energy level scheme, you have the electron, say, in spin up, then you can excite a spin down with the fundamental excitation and have a whole of spin 3 halves. So that's done with sigma plus. If you have spin down, you can have a sigma minus. In other words, one of them is left-handed, the other one is right-handed. Circularly polarized light and get a spin minus a half. So think of angular momentum addition. This gives you a plus one, so the half is 3 halves. This is minus one, but minus a half, minus 3 halves. Okay. And here we split the magnetic field along we define the z axis, which is the growth axis where you have the grow layers and then the things ball up and you have the new mass and our dots. Okay? And so that's perpendicular to the layer of semiconductors. And that's where the optical axis is also, that's where the optical. But sometimes we're going to change the magnetic field direction and put it in plane, which we call the x direction. So you have to remember that when you speak, pointing up in this direction. This is so the first thing our collaboration do is always to do spectroscopy to make sure where all the states are. This is done actually in the x direction, so these states are mixture of up and down, so that delta plus, for example, or the emission can be delta plus from higher levels. So that you can see that, in real life, there are dots that are not charged, there are dots that are charged. You put a plate, a semi-transparent plate on top, and as a gate. So the next slide will take a little while to come up because of lots of data. So first of all, let's look at the ensemble hexagon. How does that come about? You take light and you excite it. That gives you the trion that we were talking about from the electron. And then they decay. Hey, what you're left with is a spin that that then oscillates. If you have the thing in the z direction, you have the magnetic field in the x direction, then you polarize it in the z direction somehow. Explain that, and that will just precess, and it's the precession of the z. Okay, and this is an ensemble. You see the noise is pretty good, and here is a single dot. You can focus the light to I had a slide, but I didn't want to spend too much of time on it. But basically, you can have a mask of about half a micron, 0.1 micron, and grow these dots far enough away so you get about 10 dots, a dozen dots in your optical field. And these dozen dots all look different at different frequencies. Then you can just pick one. Okay? And that's actually the key to applications. But, so you can see this is pretty noisy. But this is from a single electron which got excited into a trion. And you can see the oscillation, so that gives you the signal splitting, you can measure the two factors and all sorts of things. Okay, so what we're interested in is, well, where does the spin polarization come from? From one pulse. Well, here's what it look like. Let's suppose the temperature 4 degrees is much higher than the Zeeman splitting for magnetic field in the z direction. Okay? So let's suppose that it's easier to think about this. We have done fancy calculations with master equations and everything to the right temperature interval. But think about it as equally polarized. So you have an unpolarized state like this, then of course any transformation you do with the light isn't going to change anything. So if you just do it on the two-level system, nothing's going to change. But if you have third level, what you do is that think of this zero wave vector, zero spin vector to start with that you have as a plus and minus. Okay, so when you get a pulse, what you do is, let's say we take the plus z and pump it up here. So you don't have this, now you have a spin polarization. So what happened to this guy? Well, what this guy is that it persists, but actually it would also decay. The guy that got pumped up decay. When it rained down on here, it goes to the plus x and minus x direction if the field is large compared. So if the field, if the Zeeman splitting is large compared to the lifetime, and which it can be easily because the lifetime is about 100 picoseconds. So a field of 6 Tesla, for example. So they'll come down and compensate it to zero, so you're getting, you know, half of for each, for just one shot, one pump, or one pulse. So you can just time it. This is going, this is the Z. So I should have the thing actually moved around in this, in the YZ plane. So every time it gets to here, you pump it and then off, and then you can get doing it for the remainder. So this one, it becomes this plus this, and you pump that off, and then you just keep doing that. So you can get to about 0.1% in 2 to the 10 cycles, right? So that's not impossible, and that doesn't take a whole lot of time. But in theory, so that cannot be done yet. So far, we've only done it once. But the atomic people have actually done that. So this is an idea stolen from that. I should have put their names up, but I cannot do it. So this is the, now, there's something interesting which atomic people talk about it in theory for a long time, but they never could do the experiment, because until more recently, because the atoms tumble, so it doesn't have a fixed axis. Whereas here, it's very simple. We have a dot, you take an x axis, which you fix that, and then your optical axis is the axis. Now, as we said before, we talked about polarizations when the Zeeman splitting is much bigger than the lifetime. So they just come to equal the since assuming that x and y is equal. Components of plus or minus z, right? So they will just come down equally. The spontaneous emission. But if the lifetime of this guy is actually bigger than this, then you can have coherent combination of that. Then again, you can solve it out with master equations and so on. So what you will predict is that, or you can actually just calculate with that picture that I was telling you about, of the spin vectors, and you can see the precession phase is changed, the amplitude can be changed. Well, obviously that then depends on the field. You see, a very high field, nothing much changed, but the low field changes. Right? And turns out, this is all in the data, all you have to do is to analyze it, and you can see the change in the phase and the change in the not perfectly real, the change in the amplitude and so on. So works out quite well. And this, it may not sound like a lot to you, but in atomic physics, that is the coherent splitting of which paths, you know, the eraser paradox, all sorts of good things. Okay, so, the precession is not the same as controlling the rotation. So we want to take a faster pulse, faster than one precession, one thing, precession. So we want to take this thing and rotate it in anywhere we want. All right? So how do you do that? Well, again, now you take a pulse on this, and then have to control this pulse and then control this pulse. They are centered at slightly different frequency, and then they have to be slightly off non-resonant so they don't actually excite this anymore. You see, the last time we excited, we got some very mixed states. So we want to do this pure rotation. It turns out it is possible with this so-called non-resonant Raman rotation, you can actually get any linear combination of providing two pulses. Notice because we put in the x direction, this is the only way you can rotate. But to understand what's going on, and this can be done with pulses of the order of picoseconds. You can probably do it faster, but if you do it faster, it will spread more than you start getting dissipative effect. Okay, this is an illustration which Sophia, the student, just recently did. She found in a very old literature that if you have a sec pulse, you can actually take a pulse which is centered off resonance, but get the state to go up and back again, so-called 2 pi Rabi rotation. But when it comes back, it acquired a phase, and that phase on this state, so it goes up and down, as it were, the mixture disappears. So it comes back, but it got a phase. Well, when you combine this, then you look at these two states. If you start with a linear combination, this has a phase. This is the same as rotation in the z direction. And the angle is given in terms of the non-resonance, the so-called detuning, and the this is the inverse time of the pulse length. So with optics you can do these things, and now you can do it, well, in principle you can do it. I mean, we haven't shown that yet experimentally, although there is a set of experiments, and it will be announced at the next optics meeting in May. So I shouldn't do that here. That was the work I was doing. Of Duncan's until she announced it. But I can tell you some more theory. So in general, actually, with the two pulses, you have enough parameter to control it. This is one of the things that excite the student, Paul Chung and Carlo, who do it kind of. It's like a puzzle. For the first time, they say in their life, they weren't given a Hamiltonian to solve, but they were given the final answer and said, find the Hamiltonian, they will do that. This is the Hamiltonian. You have the two time-dependent electric fields that will give you, so this is the electric field times the dipole moment that will bring it, and this has a frequency, central frequency, which is detuned. Okay, so you know this is the parameter. So for simplicity of explanation, I'm going to take one of their calculations, which says that these two has the same shape, so they're proportional to each other. So and so that the ratio of these two pulses is always at a constant. Cosine of sine beta. So beta is a constant. So I know. And then you make the phase relative to each other. And that's another knob for your Hamiltonian. And this is the central frequency knob, this one. And then from there you can deduce them, you can determine psi and phi. Well, psi is basically the Rabi frequency, or so you can use it to rotate these three things around. such that you have, provided you do it slowly enough, adiabatically enough, well, because you don't, you want this tuning to be effective, not to really not to excite this guy, and you can actually show that there's rotation. The rotation is about an axis which you can control, because the polar axis relative to the magnetic field, which is in the x direction of the space, and the light is in the z direction. So these are the polar angles. The, you know, this is theta, this is phi, this is azimuth, and so on. And notice where they come from. They come from control of the light. And then the total angle is just given by the pulse of either one strength times sine of the angle, which is defined with respect to the phasing. So I show you this in great detail. It's kind of fun if you haven't seen that before, but if you are quantum optics people, you are kind of jaded and say, well, we do that all the time. Then they say, but you can't do it in a solid. Well, we'll see. We've done enough to know that some of it can be done. Now you can simulate it also. This thing, so the decoherence, that is, we build in the fact that if you actually excite this, it takes 60 picoseconds to disappear. So that's a pretty stringent condition. And nowadays we could have used 1 nanosecond. But, this was from a first experiment. We did that. The spin decoherence is certainly longer than the 10 nanoseconds. Okay, I forgot to mention the decay from that. Long precession gives you about 10 nanoseconds. That's the so-called T2 star, the instantaneous time. Right? So you know it's much, decay from here to here is much longer than 10 nanoseconds.
So the loop,
yeah.
You plot this initial sharp decay and followed by oscillations.
Yeah.
So the initial sharp decay refers to the 60 picoseconds.
Yeah, that's a different experiment. Oh. That you take, you actually pump the resonance up to there, and then let them decay.
Remember, there was a sharp decay initial.
That's about 60. Yeah, you can measure that also. That one was about 60 or 80.
Then the oscillation consists of 10 nanoseconds. Probably.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it all looks magical, right? When the first guy did that, what could you possibly do? For the decay, remember? And the thing is about for the decay. There's a flip.
Oh, sorry. Well, this part is not important. Okay, you see it's actually interesting. So the whole operation takes about 10 picoseconds. This just tells people that 1 millielectron volt, this is a pretty sharp pulse. So you do have to worry about ionizing the crystals and so on. So you want to not use quite that much power, but 1 millielectron volt is actually weak, you know, compared to what people use to laser to cut things up. That's tiny. And by careful detuning about 5 MeV, in theory, you can get to 99% fidelity for a pi rotation. That is to take it from, say, a spin in the minus x direction to the plus x direction. That's not So that's not entanglement, just a single spin. Now, one of the things, of course, that we know that selection rule is not perfect, even in a dot, a heavy hole has a little bit mixture, not very much. This may be 0.1 to less than 10% in a dot, maybe 1%. That's the strongest mixing. Because in the whole, you have spin three halves components, so there are four components, but this is the stronger component. You can see from the Luttinger Hamiltonian. But so from our point of view, what it does is that the selection rule, you know, used to be this is permitted from spin a half to spin three halves. The long one is three halves. This is the spin. What happened? I should have. Did I get it mixed up? So this is from minus a half to a half. So that one belongs to here. This one belongs to here. So you can see, sorry, I should have plot this one over here and this one over there. But what it is that you can see, did I get this right? Oh no, this is fine. This is minus a half, this is a half, and this is a half, that's one. Yeah, sorry, I wanted this one. So you can see that sigma plus now has a little bit of leakage. So because of these transitions are possible, this is forbidden transition is possible, less than 1% certainly. But nonetheless, you punt it up to this state, it can, most of it will come back down, but some of it will leak to here. All right? What it does is for the rotational ones where we never actually excited right up there, the optical axis is now tilted slightly, and you can calculate that. So it's deterministic. You say, well, I don't trust your calculation. That's all right. We can do experiments and measure where the axis is. So it's deterministic. So it's an error only if you make the assumption it's pure, but if you know what it is, it's reproducible. And more exciting is this is really, you know, just put up on the Science Express about a couple of weeks ago. It's made use of. Okay, they say, all right, so this is forbidden. It's small, much smaller than the allowed. So you pump it up here, you're going to part of it, most of it come down, part of it will come down here. All right? Now, the direct decay is very small compared to this. Okay, so now what you do is that you do what Kassler did, the optical pumping, right? You just keep pumping it up. Most of it will come down, you just keep pumping it up. Well, part of it got leaked through here. They don't go anywhere, so it's fine. So eventually, it will all come to here. Voila. So if you wait long enough, like 30 milliseconds, you can accumulate almost all of it, right? Only 0.2% at 3 tesla. Now to see how, and this is an experiment, a real experiment, not. And this is really wonderful because, as they say, at operational temperature 4 degrees, all optics people do about the same, this is 3 teslas. To get the equivalent one of cooling, suppose you want to actually wait for this to cool, you have to raise this up to 62 tesla, not 3 tesla. So we're not going to be able to do that by simple, by waiting, by, you know, making it big and then where it is. So this is optical cooling is fine. One can pick at it. I mean, it's a bit churlish to do that because this is a difficult experiment. Imagine you have to stabilize this laser for their energy for 300 milliseconds. That's forever in our scale of 10 picoseconds, right? Nonetheless, they could do that. But, well, of course, if you want to have a fast initialization, this is too long, the optical cycling that I was talking about would actually be much faster. Still not as fast as, if I have time, I'll get to, in theory, a really fast method. Now, it's all nice and fun and games to be able to rotate one spin and to be able to do it in all directions, that would be very pretty. But first you have to prepare the spin. So I think we have a probabilistic method and we have one that certain, almost certain if you can afford to wait. So for just demonstration purposes, of course you can do that. The next thing you want to do is to say, I have two. You want to build it such that normally in ground state they don't interact with each other. All right? Now you want to control it. You want the Heisenberg interaction, but you want to control it. So you say, okay, let's take a laser and excite an electron hole pair into the continuum. In the continuum, then this guy will visit this guy and will visit this guy, and they have exchange interaction because of wave function overlap, exchange interaction overlap. And if you calculate it, actually, that will give you a, well, assuming everything is kind of isotropic, so there's the interaction. And then that is the optical analog of RKKY. It turns out Bloomberg and Roland already suggested for two atoms. So that's fine, but from solid state people point of view, how do you get the Heisenberg model? Oh, well, look, if you forget about this, you see, it's just that the spin flip excited an electron hole pair, and if you have a Fermi gas, a Fermi C, and then that's seized by another one, that's RKKY. If you don't have a Fermi C, you can excite an electron, which would do the same thing. So that's what the excitation, you can just calculate that. The nice thing about this is, unlike RKKY, you can do it without any damping term, because you can excite this virtually, again, with a detuning here. So you can control it. Basically, what you're calculating is a susceptibility diagram, time-dependent susceptibility without damping. So that will give you a control, so you can take, if there's spin up and down, you can make them either go entirely down and up or go halfway, and that will be an entangled state.
Sir, I didn't get the closing. Could you say the order in which things happen again?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, initial spins.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't do it very well. Let me. So start from here, right? I take a laser. I switch it on. Boom. I excite an electron hole pair. Okay? A wave function will go like that here. And this part of the wave function would interact with this and would interact with that. And there's an exchange interaction between this spin and this guy.
And there's nothing in the upper continuum level except the electron that you would
accept. No, it's an insulator. It's a semiconductor. So the only electrons you have are these two. And all of these. Those are all quiescent. And this is very far apart. This is 1.5 electron volts, so you don't worry about it.
That thing is, if it weren't a semiconductor but metallic system, then both electrons and the dots would interact with the metallic ones too, and that would keep you down. Right?
Yeah. So you worry about the gates and so on. Yeah, but we can keep the gate away. There is no metal. So the only thing you have to worry about is this guy comes back, right? But if I don't really excite it, then I don't have to worry about it. And it still has an action because, you can calculate the susceptibility. Then, when you calculate this, the electron hole pair, of course, attract each other, so that actually strengthens the effect. And another way is to look at this, look at the dependence between the two, the RKKY, look at the optical induced Pauli Heisenberg exchange as a function of the distance between the two dots. Okay, in three dimension, it goes like exponential of that. Well, if you think about this, this is the decay. Think of that decay distance, but think of the 1 over decay distance is the imaginary part of 2kF. If I have energies above, there will be I times RKF. That will give you the RKKY. So this is the decaying part of it. So the interaction does decay away. But all of this is pretty.
What's the length scale for that?
Kappa. Yeah, and kappa is m squared over m and detuning.
What kappa to the hole? The hole is a very short relaxation.
Yeah, so we just ignored it. Yeah. No, the ground state unless you initialize it, you don't know. So we took the first part in, say, initialize one this way, okay? But if they're both up, then this thing doesn't do anything to it, that's all. Yeah, this doesn't. Yeah. Oh, this is nicer. And this is also adiabatically, you switch it on, you switch it off. There's no, you don't shock it, you don't make it ring. That's another thing you don't want to do, is to make it ring. Yeah, if you have an ordinary RKKY, think of the time dependent RKKY, that will ring like crazy because it already has a spatial component. If you actually cut it off, it will ring. You can't afford to do that, yeah.
Your background in Shunta is hard to polarize, then the kappa decays.
That's right. But the energy that determines the kappa is not that gap. That would be very short. It's proportional to the, but basically what we have is optical excitation up to here. So this is the delta, all right? So that is the energy. So h bar squared over that gives me a distance. So I want that energy to be roughly square h bar squared over 2m kappa squared. That's my distance. Okay? So that's a much longer distance. Delta is this energy. You take your laser frequency up to here. So that's about five, detuning is about 5 milli electron volt. So this is called detuning, right? You don't want it to be resonant, so you detuned it. If you tuned it up to here, say one and a half volt, you want to be about 5 milli electron volt away from it.
The time scale, you know, what kind of time?
Yeah, that's yes. So if you want to do it adiabatically, it takes about 30 to 100 picoseconds.
With what parameter sets that?
Five MeV and, you know, a bunch of parameters like the way. And again, we take this Rabi strength to be about 1 milli electron volt. So this shows you. Yeah, sure.
So because you're below the band gap, in this off resonant condition, I guess you're not really, you're never really absorbing, right?
That's what you hope.
That's what you want, right?
Yes.
What are the processes that would give you absorption, and how do they, presumably as you increase the power, you
begin,
right?
So
is it multi-photon things, or is it
No, multi-photon thing is the least of your problems. The problem is that you need a pulse, okay? Now, I'm going to plot this pulse in energy. Of course, in time, you want the thing to be over as fast as you can, which means this guy goes up, which means you have a tail in here. Okay? Now, this is also has inaccuracy, but there are deterministic errors. That is, we actually take care of all of the, you know, in this case we say, all right, so although we pass it up to here, but you know, maybe this one over there, because everything goes like 1 over E in the susceptibility. So we just take care of all of them. Things change, but they're deterministic. So we say, well, if we can't calculate, we can always measure or learn. You know, you can use experiment to learn, which is a wonderful thing. But this gives you a scale of the thing. You can actually get it quite large between reasonable distance apart if you take the exciton into account. Then, of course, you know, the theorist then took us to task, and rightly so. So they say, look, but it's kind of like the Kondo effect, right? Even though you don't have a Fermi gas, nonetheless, there's a correlation between the continuum exciton and the continuum electron and your local electron, so you have to put the correlation in. So after much argument, I said, well, look, let's not argue. Find some young people and calculate. So we define one helpless young person. And it took him, it's not an easy calculation, especially since we argue about how what should be taken in. It turns out just the simple kinetic exchange will lower it, okay? Exciton is good to have. So here is the energy scale for J for the excitons. You see, it's much stronger than if you don't have the excitons. They just kind of scale according to him. And one dimension is better than two dimension. You know, fine. Otherwise, okay, we are half an order of magnitude off. So, but you see, it's nice to be an engineer.
So what's the conclusion of this?
That you can get about this is 0.1 millivolts. That's what we thought you can get, but at about 30. Or 20, which one we have? Yeah, you know, it's a little bit less than one, maybe one order
maybe.
Yeah. Everything worked against you. We just took the exchange.
We were too optimistic.
But that's because. So this is where it's nice to be an engineer. If continuum doesn't work, you build yourself one, so you have a second level where they, okay, guess what? That's been done now for vertical dots. Although, again, vertical dots is not the nicest thing in the world to have. And so now we have a recipe for doing this and that. We're still writing that up.
But I guess
that's much better.
Nice things of your initial idea was you could get dots that were quite far apart, talk
yeah.
to each other. And if you need to build an extra level,
yeah.
by hand, that won't work as well, right?
No, yeah, but that doesn't worry us. You know, you just do it by stages. I'll show you how to make a quantum computer without distant interaction. Okay. Now this is something that I need to go quickly. This is something very interesting. If you have a cavity, so imagine, it doesn't have to be these ring cavities, any cavity you put the dot in here. The idea is what Wang Yao and Renbo Liu found was if you can actually control a single photon coming out. Okay, single photon wave packet of any shape. Just specify the shape. They can choose a pulse shape and feed it in, you know, in time, one little at a time in here. and produce that wave packet of a single photon. That means also I can produce a photon wave packet of mixed of a linear combination of zero and one state, with the one state of particular shape pulse by controlling the pulse that excites the spin in here. This is the selection rule now that we use for the spin in the x and y direction with the linearly polarized light of the two trions, so that the x rotate this way, y rotate the other way. So you can do that. Well, I don't know, this may be too much detail, but it's kind of interesting. What you do is that here's the red pulse first. In order to generate a photon, for example, you first of all, you let this trion to be out of resonance with the cavity mole. That's what the cavity is for. So this is quantum electrodynamics. You first take this, you shift it. You can pump this. This is what is it called? A stock shift, AC stock shift, right? You move it with an AC pulse. And then when this is here, you excite this guy to here. Because of the coupling, it would decay and one photon would come out, but the photon has nowhere to go except here, so it comes out here. And the thing is that by changing the laser, which is macroscopic, I can get one microscopic. So this is really pretty quantum mechanics, you know. Schrodinger equation, but you have to know exactly how to build it to solve it. Solving it is not hard, but building it is. So that gives you two things already. A single photon source of any shape, any duration you want. And it's ultra-fast cooling because I can put all of these things now, all the electron, the part of the electron state plus to this state. And it's fast. This is very fast. This is just one pulse. Bing, goes. And even better, I didn't talk about measurement. There's the usual nonlinear measurements that Duncan does, but those are ensemble measurements. You need to collect many photons. This is all you need. Well, I say all you need is a single photon detector. Because now instead of pumping from here, you just say, well, I want to see whether this state is occupied or not. So I take a light. If it is occupied, I can pump it up to here first step. And then I take this thing and move it up to there. If there is a state, it would couple to the cavity and decay and come out of here, and then you set here, and then it triggers single photon detection. If you don't have a single photon detector, it doesn't matter. You let that guy go, collect it, and then you do it again. You know, because it will come down here, so you can cycle it. And that's a non-demolition experiment, quantum non-demolition experiment. Now, if it's not taught to your students, maybe you should, in quantum mechanics, you should start thinking about teaching people something like this. What is one that can be demolished, or quantum mechanical? Well, say, for example, I measure the position with a certain uncertainty. You say, well, it doesn't matter what the uncertainty of the momentum is. Correct. At that moment, it doesn't matter. But later on, it will come back and bite you because this thing says that I have a free particle. The distance traveled. So if you want to measure a later time, this gives you a huge uncertainty, right? So this is called back action noise. You can measure it once, you can't measure it again, whereas that experiment that we designed can be measured it over and over again. So what it takes is that your measurement operator has to commute as a function of at different times. These cavities can be built, and what's more, this is fairly controversial. As a function of temperature, people have seen the cavity more in this cross. Guess what? This is 0.1 splitting. This is what we use for simulation. I didn't show you all the simulation curves.
Why is it controversial?
Temperature. people can be pretty tough. Wait, you were there. You were one of the guys. Were you one of the nasty guys? No, I can't remember. But they said, look, it's just two lines crossing. How do you know this is cavity, this is dot, right? Kind of thing like that. So you have to prove it is. The splitting part is fine. It could be impurity, it could be anything. So, okay, let me just wind up by saying, look, we can build a... again, now this is all theory. In theory, you can build a quantum computer, you can build a distributed quantum computer or network with all those cavities and cables, and then you can also use the quantum dot as a nonlinear. That is the one that I hope that I can convince people to do first. Because you can also do it not with just one dot. The thing is that you always have to do things with a collection of dots, do some ensemble things. Okay, so this is the quantum computer. You were asking about the distance interaction. Well, just think of them. First of all, just remind you, this is a single rotation, and these two, I use AC Stark effect to get into resonance. Then you see those two levels, then I just optically excited to that level, and the electrons would visit these two spins. That gives me the interaction. Nearest neighbor is fine, because I can just do nearest neighbor and then nearest neighbor over again. And how do I distinguish them? See, in this collection, I distinguish them by their frequencies. And this is we have another method for cooling using phonons that are much faster for initialization. And measurement is a difficult part, so we use an old-fashioned one. So this is done without cavity. Now this is an architecture. So okay, here's 0.2 microns optical spot. The laser is important. You fix the laser. Because if you any mechanical movements, your time, your clock speed would be off, right? So here you just optical pulses. And it covers about a dozen of these guys in two dimension, like in here it covers about three, but whatever, a dozen. So you frequency distinguish them. So within each fold, you dress by frequency. So we simulated a 7-dot for factorizing 15. There's a reason for why to do 15. But and this was challenged by the one of the funders who actually gave us some money to do it, just to show that. He says, well, look, I'm in optics. You're going to need a room full of lasers. Since I knew him well from his previous life as a scientist, I kidded him and said, look, I can do it with the lasers that you have in your pocket, right? That drives your CDs. And he said, show me. Here's $25,000. So, okay. So we did this. It took a lot of time to design the pulses and count up the number of pulses and the power the time consumptions and so on. It's not bad. It takes about 100 pulses, basically. This is the standard things there in the books. This is, you know, once you do specific things, you can have some clever things. That's another thing about engineering, even quantum engineering. Once you start having to solve problems, things make better. Not, of course, exponentially better, but in practical terms. So it's not bad. So the distribution, let me just show you running. Source. You know, people made source with these cavities. So it's a cavity in this pillar. Beautiful work. So here's how our dream is. This is the new quantum information highway. Okay, waveguide. And here's a dot with an electron in it. And then that's the initial state. You prepare it in that state. And then you initialize the pulses here first so that this will be a down state or some ground state, it doesn't matter. And then you do a pulse here to change this guy to get rid of, say, the up part, in which the up part comes into here and excite it, and photon come out where it is, and then that goes along. That goes along, propagates into here, and it gets received. And then you have to time now. So this, the clock speed is important. You have to time this guy so that as it come in, you control it so that the whole thing will come in. If you let it come in by itself, you know, a lot of optics people just say, well, I do some coating, blah, 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 it will just all come in. Well, most of it will be bounced back. So here, this is a full control, at least in theory. So this gives you swaps, entanglement, distance entanglement, all the good things in theory. Okay. Now this one might actually work fast. You have two, again, waveguides, two photons come in here, interact with the cavity. The cavity then interacts with this very nonlinear two-level system of the spin dot, or three-level system, and you can actually get the make a phase gate out of it. All right. But as one of my students, somebody told me, one of my students gave a talk, and they said, you know, how soon would you see that? He said, well, my advisor may not live to see it, but I will live to see it. So, okay, that's a good time to stop. I suppose I should have given you the conclusion, but you can see it.
So that's a yaw?
No, he's... He's too nice to say that. One of the more rambunctious guys. So the idea is, I guess my message would be that the spin is actually quite a robust. You need to look beyond Hartree-Fock theory to show that. And there are things which are not perfect, but you can either use the experiment to learn from it or do some calculation. And I think there's been actually very interesting progress. And working with experimentalists, it's wonderful. I have boundless admiration for them. Just having to work everything on real time. You know, the theory, so you can't solve the problem, have a coffee and solve it another day. Doesn't work that way with experiments. But potentially, you see, I mean, I spent really a lot of time for this, but I really didn't spend enough time on telling you the difficulties and how to overcome them, like pulse shaping, but we have things like that. The possibility really is only limited by our imagination. Look at the phase gate that Wang Yao invented. Really, just amazing. You know, let the kids... free. So the lesson is not to give the student a Hamiltonian and demand the ground state. Give them the ground state and demand the Hamiltonian. Okay. Shall we?
You mentioned pulse shaping at the end. Could you say a little bit what you're doing in that direction?
Okay, suppose I want to do, one of the things that I learned by, you know, at Boulder is I say, well, I want to do pulse shaping, tell me how to pulse shape. They say, oh, what you need is peanuts. So I was going to do operation by operation. They say, on the other hand, So what you do is that things like this. if I make this very slow, I make it very fast, energy will be very broad, I'm starting disturbing, exciting electrons where I don't want them to. Okay, so for example, if I have a typical thing we have simulated, you have a four level system, this is two exciton, the sum of the two exciton is up here. So this guy is not exactly the same that guy. This is, if you excite this, gives you a C naught operation. If you excite this, you give a single rotation, qubit rotation. Okay. So you don't want to do. So what you want to do? Suppose you want to do C naught and not excite this. What you need is then a pulse that's centered about here, but somehow, roughly speaking, canceled out with some chirping and so on, cancel out this effect. So the dynamics is very pretty. When you do this thing, the spin rotates here and this guy actually come back to sleep. It's not that you don't disturb it. There's no such thing as not disturbing the sleeping cats. You always disturb it, but you...
But how do you actually do that calculation? What methods do you use to determine the best pulse rate?
Oh, search. Numerical search. Put some parameters into two Gaussians, phase differences, and then just search. We only searched about the two, three, four parameter spaces. Then we had a brilliant student from, she was a very well organized student from Stanford, undergraduate, just say, I saw it on your website and this is what I want to spend my summer. So she has search algorithm, which you put in a notebook, put all the graduate students to shame. I said, this is how I want my programs documented. Sheer hard work, it's not very... No.
You know, they are from NMR community, very highly optimized,
Yes.
Very yes. Powerful ways to do pulse shaping.
Yes.
I learned from Pangulian.
I'd like to talk to you some more, you'll be here. But I find those completely useless because we are pulse shaping in the frequency space. They have such a luxury of, oh, so when you do simulation, all the decoherence you put in, okay, optical decoherence, spin decoherence, the spin decoherence is unimportant. But they can afford to do things like a pulse, do the spin and wait for the interaction to rotate. We cannot afford to do that. Our interaction is 0.1 MeV. You know how long 0.1 MeV is, right? It's 0.0 MeV, 1 MeV, so that's 100 picoseconds. Well, or if it's 0.01, that's 1,000 picoseconds. So well, that's 1 nanosecond. Suddenly, things get much too long for us. They can afford it because they have decoherence times that runs forever. Okay, so what they do is that they do time pulses and wait in between. We take it all at the same time, just take frequency shaping. So. But there are optical techniques for doing that. So we really haven't had time to do all that yet. But the most wonderful thing that I learned is they said, you can't do the pulse shaping once, twice, you know, because the elasto-optic switches recover in 1 nanosecond. I said, well, 1 nanosecond, my computing is done, so I can't afford that. They said, that's right. So then I found out with all those pixels, you can do all the pulses. So for example, for that 100 pulses, I can pulse shape the whole 100 pulses, one big pulse, and I send it in, you calculate, and then we're done. So that's the concept. We haven't done it yet. I'm running out of manpower. There's so many things to do. So it's exciting. Sorry, we better let John talk. I promised to give it to him at 12:30. No, but...